This is The Guardian.
For every $1 for social housing, $5 is going into tax concessions for people who by definition already have capital. But the price of taking that away is different to giving something that people don't already have. So maybe framing it up more around that sort of choice would actually create a way of recasting a political argument that has been run a number of times now and looks like it's a hard one to prosecute.
Hello, I'm Paul Karp, Chief Political Correspondent at Guardian Australia, coming to you from the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples. Today, my guest is Peter Lewis, the Executive Director of Essential Media, and we're talking about the latest Guardian Essential poll. Hello, Peter.
Hey, Paul.
I just needed to have the auctioneer's level of excitement and enthusiasm for the property we're about to be selling, because this fortnight's poll focused mainly on the housing system, and respondents to the poll thought that the housing system was failing. They gave low marks to all levels of government on how they're doing. And when you put a bunch of different solutions in front of them, from Labor's shared equity to the Coalition Super for Housing and the Greens' public sector property developer, they said yes to all of the above. So people were grasping for their paddles, desperately wanting a solution.
Indeed. And I'm loath to quote myself, Paul, but I did say in The Guardian this week, housing in Australia is a bin fire stoked by shysters pumping up their assets for short-term advantage to the detriment of those they claim to serve. And that's just the policy auction. So that's what we got into in the report this week. We tried to look at housing, which is a really complex issue, from a whole bunch of different angles, but predominantly from the angle of the voter, because I think more than any other issue, I think that there are so many interests that are locked in that the conversation with the voter often gets lost. And is housing an economic story? Is it a community story? Is it a story about one of the most fundamental needs that people have, and how those mush together determines the sorts of policies at all levels of government? And it's a really fluid field at the moment, because flaws in our system that have been evident for a while are coming to the pointy end, both with interest rates rising, with rising rentals, with the fact that Australia's rental market is one of the most unstable in the world. And then add into that the pressure of increased numbers of both visas and immigration and international students, and it's a heady mix, of which the end point is, what are the biggest issues this year? Cost of living and housing, and what does it even mean?
Well, now that we've set the scene, let's start with what people think housing is for.
So those three, we basically gave people three options, which is closest to your personal view. First, on the role housing should play, and then what is the role it currently does play. And the three options were housing as a basic human right that everyone should have access to, housing as the foundation for vibrant communities, and housing as a vehicle for growing personal wealth. And in the world of should, 73% go for the basic right, 18% community, just 9% for growing personal wealth. Then the world that is, that 9% that it's a personal wealth driver goes from 9% to 35%, and housing as a basic right drops from 73 to 45. There's lots of ways we could slice and dice this, which of course we do, and we have if people want to go to essentialreport.com.au. But probably the most stark of the changes was not age, which we normally think, but was around whether people invest in property or not. So if people declare themselves somebody who own an investment property, much less likely to see it as a basic right, much more likely to see it as a vehicle for personal wealth.
That makes sense. But despite that difference on people who have an investment property, if you just looked at their living situation by mortgage status, there wasn't much difference. You know, renters agreed with homeowners, agreed with those with or without mortgage, pretty much in saying, yes, that housing should be a basic human right.
Indeed. I don't think And I try to unpack a bit this in my piece. I don't think that invalidates the economic arguments. It's just, where is the point that the discussion should start? And I would argue that most of the discussion in our policy framework is around how we get more people to build personal wealth. So the discussions around, and we'll go into specific policies that we checked out, I know, down the track, but, you know, the Liberals pushing for dipping into your retirement savings to get into the property market, or previously there's been first home buyer schemes or shared equity schemes. It's all very much through an economic framework rather than that social good framework. And one of the questions is, if you start with the social good or the basic right, does the system look different?
So fewer than 1 in 10 wanted housing to be a vehicle for wealth. And that was also reflected when you ask people if they wanted property prices to rise, stay the same, or reduce. What did you find there?
So yes, 15% would like to see property continue to rise, 45% stabilise, 40% reduce. So you can obviously slice or dice that a number of ways. Given that it's rising at the moment, even stabilisation is an intervention. So you've got, you know, 85% of people saying stop the rise.
And that means there are people that own homes, living in homes, that don't want to see the value of them continue to rise. Perhaps, you know, people worried about how their kids are ever going to get into the market, or, you know, they're just enjoying the imputed rent from having a roof over their head. They're not looking for stonking capital gains.
Indeed. Although, you know, investment, again, hello investors, those who own at least one investment property, 29% of you would like to see your investments continue to rise, and God bless you all. Those who don't own investment properties, just 13% wanting that value to rise, but they can still obviously have their own home. 43% of those without investment properties would like to see the price reduce.
People with a mortgage, 21% wanted to see it continue to rise, which is a little higher than the general stat of 15. But homeowners without mortgages, once they've paid it off, they're just like the rest of people, 14% continue to rise. They're happy already.
Their work is done. And also the other one that really stands out, renters without mortgages, 56% of those would like to see the price reduce, 31% stabilise. Although I do want to find the 13% of renters who want to see prices rising. They've either got good inheritances coming down the line, or something else is going on there.
I think the ones that want it to reduce, in millennial speak, is pop you bastard. You know, that there's a property bubble, the value is inflated. Pop you bastard means, you know, let's let's see it crashing down to earth somewhere closer to where I might be able to get in on the action.
It was like that Winnie the Pooh when he was up in the air. Yeah, it's very good.
And now people were quite stroppy with how of all levels of government were doing at handling the housing system. What did you find in terms of the blame game for local, federal and state government?
Well, no one's hitting it out of the park, Paul. Very good, quite good, neutral, quite poor, very poor. We get the positives and negatives and keep the middle. In terms of combined very good and quite good, local government 23%, federal government 19%, state government 19%, and then going back on the inverse, 50% poor state government, and that's obviously all state governments combined depending what state people are in, 47% federal government doing a bad job, and 41% thinking local government's doing a bad job. So in everything, there are more people thinking they're doing a bad job than a good job, but that reflects the fact that everyone thinks it's a bin fire.
Hmm. Is there any difference in terms of regional and cities or what state people are in? Because, you know, it is the big cities that are the priciest.
Yeah, and it is true that different states at the moment are running different policies. So Victoria is running a big social housing build. Queensland's moving down that path as well. New South Wales is more going for supply, let it rip.
Yeah, well, both New South Wales and Victoria are trying to improve density around transport connections, but the New South Wales model is maybe less directed to social housing.
Yeah, so New South Wales, well, all I can say is that's federal government. On state government, the New South Wales, 21 positive, 43 negative. Victoria, 23 positive, 54 negative. And Queensland, 14 positive, 56 negative. So it might just be a function of how long they've been in power for as well. So none of them, again, covering themselves in glory. But it is tough, isn't it? Because between those three levels of government, you've got local governments that sort of represent the voice of communities in terms of standards and what they want to be having. Then you've got the states, which are in charge of public housing, where they've got tight budgets and they struggle to invest in it. They're also responsible for rental management. And you've got the feds who pull the tax levers. And, you know, they have been, you know, the federal government has been bringing in a number of initiatives around freeing up both the social housing stock through the HAF scheme, the acronym of which I've got no idea.
Housing Australia Future Fund.
Oh, thank you, Paul. And the other one, which is a little pilot shared equity scheme. So there's a few things going on, but I think it's almost like the issue, because we're in that sort of knot between what is housing for, it's almost bigger than government to solve right now. And I think that reflects in the way that people responded to the plethora of policy ideas we put in front of them. They just said, yep, we'll take the lot.
Well, before we get on to solutions, just one last measure of how stroppy people are about all of this. You asked, does the housing system need a lick of paint or some minor renovations or a knockdown rebuild? And what did you find?
Well, the housing system is largely working well and does not require change, 9%. The housing system is not working in some parts and need change in those areas, 47%. And housing system is broken and needs to be fundamentally rethought, 43%, which is a big number. And it's a number that gets bigger depending your own situation. 57% of renters reckon the whole thing's stuffed and needs to be rethought. Just 35% of those with a mortgage, 33% of those without. Any big changes in voting intention? Greens and independent other parties are much higher in terms of burn the whole thing down and start again. I know you can't really do that with a house. 59 to 55.
Sound like you're doing an insurance job rather than a construction
job. I know. One after dark. And I'm just looking at investment property ownership. Oh, that's good. People with at least one investment property think it's doing okay. Not overwhelmingly, but they're not as worried than the rest of us.
Now, you gave people a menu of possible policies and solutions, and you didn't tell them which political parties were pushing these, but I can see some fingerprints of particular political parties on some of these solutions. What was on the menu and what were people most enthusiastic for?
They were enthusiastic for the lot. So we did, five different ideas, and these aren't exclusive. We didn't actually go down anything around the more fundamental issues around immigration and population. We were just looking at the levers on housing. So remove tax concessions like negative gearing and capital gains tax discounts for property investors, which is obviously the policy that Labor took 2019, 2016, did not take to 2022. 51% support, 19% opposition, and then 30% in the middle. So majority support, but not overwhelming. That was the lowest one. So the next one, expand shared equity schemes where people take a stake in part of their home in partnership with government or a private investor to reduce the upfront cost, which is that pilot that the government's running. The length of the question implies that it is a difficult thing to explain, but 54% support, 13% opposition. Expand public sector property development to limit private sector property prices, which was the big Max Chandler Mather
at the
bid
press club
from a few weeks ago. I kind of liken that to offering something new and asking people to buy off the plan. That's 57% support, 11% opposition, allowing first home buyers to dip into their superannuation to help them purchase their first home. The braggart strategy of the Liberal Party, again, 57% support for that. So that's interesting. So both the Green and the Liberal policy ideas have 57% support, and I'll have a look at voting.
They have their nose in front
of
the shared equity scheme.
Yeah, and it's interesting. The Greens are actually more likely to support the superannuation dip in than Lib voters. Liberal voters less likely to support the socialisation of the property sector, though. So that's interesting. So
that'd be age, though, wanting to get at the super. If you're 40 years instead of 20 years away from retirement, then you might prefer the money now.
Yeah, and the one that is out by an extra 10% at 68% support was provide additional support to not-for-profit community housing providers to deliver social housing, which of course is the one that no one can afford to do because budget. So a lot of the other ones are about playing with other people's money. That's the only one where it's actually taxpayer funded. I guess you could argue the shared equity is some upfront government funding, but they also managed to keep the equity in the properties they're investing in. So that's interesting, isn't it? So the thing that people actually want is social housing more than all the others, and it's probably the least likely to land. That's depressing, sorry.
Yes, although Labor did announce $3 billion for social and affordable housing, which, you know, the Greens took credit for because it was during the negotiations for the HAF, and they say that was something that they won. And, you know, even the Coalition wasn't opposed to that in the end because they were saying, oh, you know, at least it's money for housing rather than this investment thing. So,
but how many homes is that to build over the next term? Is it 5,000?
I haven't got those stats in front of me, but my point is that a lot of these policies, you can identify one particular political party pushing it, whereas it seemed that the one that was most popular, actually everyone is in favour of, just maybe to different degrees.
But just to give listeners a context of that, currently the national waiting list for social housing is 178,000 households, where the average wait is about 10 years. And I think this scheme, for all that money at the moment, is building, I think, 5,000 over the next period. So there is a lot of opportunity there if, A, there was the funds, or B, other ways of providing the opportunities to get more of the stock for poor people. So the difference is there's a lot of affordable housing initiatives where developers allocate part to be a little bit under market rent, but it's still, you know, if you're in an expensive area, it's still going to be an expensive house. But these are, can you interrupt the market? And I think it talks to that sort of broader discussion we had before. Is it a right or is it an economic unit? And if it's a right and you build lots of housing for poor people as your starting point, it actually changes the whole dynamic of the market.
Were you surprised that attacking the tax concessions, negative gearing and capital gains scraped into majority support at 51%?
Well, only scraped in or managed to scrape in?
Well, it depends whether you're a glass half full or half empty person.
Oh, I mean, you know,
on the one hand, you'd want a handier lead if you're encouraging a progressive government to do it. On the other hand,
correct,
it's impressive that a majority of people want more tax on this asset class.
Yeah, look, it didn't have a huge difference between those who own properties and don't. It's the one where you're materially taking something away. Like, so I think that's probably the difference. My friends at Per Capita, who run the Centre for Equitable Housing, were telling me that at the moment it's about $17 billion a year going into negative gearing and capital gains concessions, as opposed to about $3.5 billion going into social housing. So for every dollar we put into social, we're putting $5 into tax concessions for people who by definition already have capital. But the price of taking that away is different to giving something that people don't already have. So, but I think that's a really neat little, you know, inflection point. For every $1 for social housing, $5 is going into those tax concessions, and maybe framing it up more around that sort of choice would actually create a way of recasting a political argument that, you know, has been run a number of times now and looks like it's a hard one to prosecute. I just think also if you talk to people, like, and we've done this differently, we didn't put the limit on it. Previously, we've had better numbers on there where we say we limit it to 3 or 4 properties. So that's the other way of looking at how negative gearing might be phased down.
And you've mentioned some differences by age and political party. What about in terms of people's housing status? Did that affect which solutions they preferred?
No, and nor did age. Oh, like a little bit on...
Renters were keener on most of the solutions, weren't they?
They were on dipping into their super. 61% was higher than the other classes. Yeah, they're about 5% up on most of them, but on negative gearing capital gains, they were no different to people with a mortgage. And again, your thesis that, well, those without a mortgage was your thesis, wasn't it? That they earned the right to not be, well, they're less
too blessed to
financially
be
insecure. Yeah. But no, it doesn't really, they're not miles apart compared to the broader statements. Like everyone's just saying, yeah, do it on all the different policies. I think the risk is there that you get a policy gumbo and none of it really gets to the heart of the matter.
Hmm.
But who do I know? I'm a pollster, not a policymaker.
There were a few questions about economic security generally. Are you ready to move away from housing or is there anything else you wanted to pull out of the numbers?
It's almost like we've set up shop here, isn't it, Paul?
It's not quite going yet, but if last bits for housing questions or...
To the man and the suit down in the Canberra pod cave.
No, okay.
No, sir. We'll pass. What are we saying? Economic outlook on conditions. This is a long-term trend line we've been running since December 08, and it's been a wild old ride. The highest point of people think things were going to get better was back in October 09. Where were you in October 09? That was...
maybe second year uni.
Kevin was still in ascendance. So, yeah, 68 at that time thought we'd be... That's rud optimism. It went all the way down...
It's like we bounced out of the GFC, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, when your economic strategy is to pump money into the economy, the times tend to be good as well. Down to 16% by October 11, and then back up 38% in 13. I'm just enjoying this journey, folks. And then over the last couple of years, total better. The highest it's been was June 22, which was probably the last time we emerged from lockdowns, 32%. It's down to 21% now, getting worse, peaked recently in February at 56%. It's dropped off a bit to 48. So at the moment, net total worse, 48, better, 21, stay the same, 27. And it's a simple question. I should have started with the question, not the answer. Sorry, everyone. In the next 12 months, do you think that the Australian economic conditions of Australia will improve, stay the same, or get worse? So I think the one interesting bit there is, so the expectation is still a bit less than a few months ago or a year ago, but still pretty strongly that things are going to get worse rather than better, 48-21. I think part of the sort of narrative is that things will get better next year and that the Labor government might benefit from things getting better, interest rates no longer going up. There's been talk that energy prices will stabilise. I don't know what you think, Paul, whether that's sort of counterintuitive or if there is an expectation of negativity and then the economy outperforms that, whether that is a benefit to incumbent.
Well, you can obviously see why in February 2023, in the middle of the interest rate hiking cycle, people would be overwhelmingly saying, or they'd be negative. It's 56% saying getting worse. Mm. I take your point, 48 to 21, there are still more people that say that it will get worse, even though we're expecting a rate cut or two in the next 12 months. But, you know, if you've been used to the mortgage rate being at emergency levels, you know, near zero levels, and then you've taken out a huge loan, it's gone up to 6%. One or two rate reductions off that and keeping rates at 5.5%, you could still be in for a world of pain. And you've been paying higher rates for a few years now, so you might have run down your savings by now. So that makes sense to me.
Total worse amongst renters, 53%. So they're an outlier. They're 10% worse than others as well. Just thought I'd go back to the... housing for 1 minute.
So they see only one direction because there's not going to be a whole bunch of new houses for rent in the next 12 months.
You wouldn't think so, would you?
And outside of housing and the economy, you did ask a question about the government's deportation bill. You put two of its central planks to respondents to see what they thought. Where did they land on those?
Well, 51 and 50. So non-citizens who refuse to cooperate with deportation can be punished with a minimum 1 year in prison. 51% support, 17% opposed, 32% not view either way. And then, as you said, the other one, countries who refuse to, people deported by Australia can be blacklisted from further visa. Again, 50% support, 14% opposition, 36% meh. Now, I think that the big standout here is amongst older voters as opposed to youngers, over 55s, it's 65, 66, and they're obviously also going to be more likely to be voting conservatively. Yep, Liberals, 64, 59, or coalition, and then sort of independent, handsome, those crowds, 58, 57. So big age and so it is a polarising issue. I think then the question there is going to be one of salience. Like, is this an issue that Labor can lock down and move on from, or does it stay as a defining issue? Like, if that was all people were talking about for the next 12 months, then you could see how that could be a political problem. But I think what they're trying to do is shut it down because it's playing into their opponent's strength. And I know a couple of weeks ago we just did that dummy run of who's the better party at protecting our borders. And it's still like, it's not the game that Labor wants to be playing. Not that it's a game, but it's not the field on which they want to be engaging.
Yeah, and I should note that YouGov, they also polled this issue about banning visa applications from a particular country. But they, unlike your question, they didn't give them the reason why the government is doing that. So you supplied that it was because the countries refused to accept people being deported from Australia. YouGov didn't give them that information. And YouGov gave them a different option. They said, should we treat all visa applications on an individual merit basis, regardless of country of origin? And when you put it that way, they found 60% said, treat the visa applications on merit. Less than a third, 31%, said the government should have the power to ban all visa applications from a particular country, and 9% said don't know. So it really shows it depends what information you put in front of people in terms of what they go for. Yeah. Because both the question designs weren't completely accurate reflection of the measure. But when you say nice things about non-discrimination, people piled on that option for you guys.
Yeah, you know, you don't, it's interesting, you don't need to push poll. Like that's a framing issue. So whether you frame it around equality or you frame it around difference. But I think if 60% of people were opposed to the propositions the coalition were making at the moment, they wouldn't be making them so vociferously, and the government for that matter. Like, we shouldn't kid ourselves. On issues around crime, law and order, borders, it is still politically popular to go tough, and part of the challenge of progressive politics is to reframe and reprioritise issues so that this isn't the centre of people's worlds.
I think that's all we have time for, and I already used the going, going, gone joke in the middle of the episode, so I can't do that here, but we'll see you next fortnight.
Thanks, Paul.
This episode was produced by Karishma Luthraya and Alison Chan. The executive producer of Australian Politics is Molly Glassie. I'm Paul Karp. We'll have another episode of Australian Politics for you on Saturday. Thanks for listening.